You know, I had never thought of that, because what we were talking about just then. Don't scrape it, Faye. I'll cook that for you, Clown. There wasn't much hard work to it. It wasn't even hot. You get used to it. And you're out where the air moves. And you working along with hoeing or what you're ever doing. Fine, doesn't matter. And you're not putting out. You what do? You hit your stride.
Hit your stride and just keep going. Just like stacking hay. You would have to stack all of our hay out.
Yeah.
Lots of people, if they got two stacks a day, they was doing good.
I get it just a minute.
They was doing good. But I took our force. There was three other boys big enough to work. I brought them. See, Opal, she never would get out in the field. Aulita, older sister. And Daddy. It was nothing for us to stack 8 stacks of hay a day.
Yeah.
It was nothing, and we did it all by horses.
Yeah.
Yeah? That's right.
Well, now, let me tell you, Queen. I never did that. I don't know the motion of that hay stacking. What'd you put it on?
Stacked it around a pole.
On the ground?
No. We got took boards and chunks and stumps.
Yeah.
Built up off the ground a little bit.
That keeps it from drawing moisture.
Moisture, that's right. Just anything to kill it, just to have a draft underneath it.
Just a little air. A useful pole.
We usually use a popper pole or about 4 inches in diameter. About 18 feet long.
Yeah. How long would it stay there?
We stack around 2 years.
Yeah. And it's hard to think you don't have a poplar down here.
Poplar, you know, is as straight as a dime. This is straight as it could be.
Easy to work.
Easy to work. Light to work. Poplar, cucumber, sassafras.
And then, now, on loading the wagon, I know kind of how to do that. You sort of spread it out, keep it from getting lumpy, and get it big at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how you do that around the haystack.
Basically the same, only you keep, when you're stacking around a pole, you keep right around that pole, you keep it full. It don't make a difference whether it's lumpy or not, just keep it full.
Around the pole.
And just keep pushing it out around, build it as big around as you want it.
Oh.
And when you want to taper out and top out, well, start letting it come in a little bit.
Yeah.
I can put Alice on a stack, on a pole, and stack a stack of hay with her. If she'll do what I tell her to do.
That simple. You're tired? Just lay it up there.
Just lay it up there, trump it down, top it out, twist a little bit around the pole, and trump it down good, and slide down.
Yeah. What do you do at the top?
How do we do it at the top? Take hay, a bunch of hay, medium-sized forkful, and you start tromping it around. Just keep stringing it out, tromping it around and around and around. Tromp it down. Beat it down on the side as you fork. You see, it runs up to a peak like that. When you get to the top, well, I just twist you some around the top, pump it down, beat down around with your fork, and tell them to get out of the way, you're coming down, slide down.
I can't quite picture it. We might have occasion to stack a little sometime.
I think they're pretty out in the field.
They are.
Does really it keep?
Yes, sir.
Well, let me tell you, one thing I learned is for corn, you don't need a crib. You don't need to have it indoors.
No. Not down here, you don't.
Not down here.
Now, of course, back up in the country where it snows and all that, where it'll be rode down on the ground, then you've got to make provisions to get it up. If it'll stay up,
well,
it's
all right. You put a you just put you some poles around it and wrap a little fencing over my fence.
Mm-hmm.
And put your lid on it. That's the only important thing.
Just put your top on it. That's the only thing.
That's the only thing. And you can just let it set right out there with the wind and everything blowing through it.
Yeah, if it gets wet, the wind will blow it out.
I don't think the wet has a thing to do with it, do you? Up there. Now, down here, I don't know, Cookie, down here, the weevils are bad.
Oh, yeah.
But now, as far as I know, that keeps all right.
Keeps better that way than it does if you put it in a tight place where it can't get a sufficient amount of air.
Yeah.
I know Dad, he built a big crib on the end of his barn. It's 3 foot wide, 3 foot wide, 20 foot long.
Oh.
And 9 feet high.
Yeah.
So 456 bushels of corn.
Yeah.
And we planted 4 acres of corn and filled that corn crib full.
Yeah. Where'd you get that idea of making it narrow?
It'd fit along the edge of the barn, see?
Yeah.
Wouldn't extend too far out.
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't be so deep for what the corn would dry out in the fall, early fall of the year when we would get it.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
When he built that barn, why, heck, we cut our corn by hand and shocked it up in the field, you know, back on top of the mountain. I mean, there wasn't no level land. We didn't grow corn on level land. It was against the hillside. That's where we done all our plowing and everything. That first 6 acres that Dad had cleared, that's where I almost got killed.
Of corn?
Yeah. Had 6 acres of new ground cleaned up, you know. And he got one crop off of it. The next spring, he went to work at Alloy. And he wanted to plant it in corn. And I was back a plowing. He wanted to turn with a turn plow. A number 10 Vulcan turn plow. He wanted that turn with it.
Yeah. Bust you.
I was 12 years old. And had a pair of horses. Good pair of horses. They wasn't big, but they were good. That was the year that I broke the little sorrel mare. And Daddy got off of Grandpa. We called her Babe. Her and Dewey. Old Dewey was a horse about like a little man. Just about such a horse as a little man.
quick motion.
Yeah.
But if you work them a day, they don't, their motion not quite as quick.
Oh, he's well. Just like that. He'd come off that hill of eating, feeling just as good as he was that morning when he went on. Now, babe, she was different. She was quiet, easy going. Of course, now they were both, you put them in a mower machine, and they would gait together. They would gait together. But I caught that plow caught behind a blackjack stump. They broke the front clevis on the turn plow. And they went, when it hit them, why, they jumped, you know, naturally. My dad always taught me to plow with a line around my waist. Right around my waist, you know. Well, the horses didn't stop quick enough. They pulled me, plow and all, just flipped me for a loop, about 20 foot right down over the hill. And it knocked me slap out. Them horses stood there all day long. My sister come on the hill at 5:30 that evening, and I just begin to come to enough to where I knew where I was at. See, I didn't go in for dinner. They knew there's something wrong. But still nobody come see about me. And when 5:00 come and I wasn't home, they knew good and well somebody better go see about me. And that's where they found me. Old Dewey and Babe was standing right there. They hadn't moved. Stood right there all day long. I guess that's one time I'm lucky.
Yes, sir.
What was the idea of putting the reins around your waist?
You couldn't hold them in your hands.
Yeah.
And hold a plow at the same time.
Yeah.
Because plowing a new ground, mister, that's rough.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And I wasn't any bigger than a mantle anyway. But there was a type, them horses was the type of horses that would, on the hillside, they would turn the plow around for me. I didn't have to. I didn't have to man it. All I had to do was kick the latch and lean the plow over sideways. Them horses would turn it around. They'd keep them traces tight and stay up against it and ease it around for me. Very seldom did I ever have to pull that plow back up a hill to get it in line with the fur. Very seldom. Them horses would keep it up for themselves.
Well, you'd have to yank it back and
I mean, hit a root, I'd have to pull it back, yeah. And that point to stick out there and get under one of them old blackjack roots or a white hickory root. They wasn't no giving to it. They couldn't break it.
No.
And I've had to take an axe and chop the plow out lots of times.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, what were you supposed to do when you'd think it'd all be slow motion, but it ain't. When the horses come up against something like that, then they push a little harder. It flips your handles.
That's right. They come up, they'll be walking longer, just riding along, and all once they hit something solid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just like a governor.
Yeah. Automatically, well, they squat and start getting with it. That's the way we broke them to do, see?
Yeah.
They didn't fly back. There wasn't no fly back in them horses. No, sir.
That's right.
When they hit something solid, well, the dirt commenced flying.
Yeah.
and if something was going to give, and that time the wrong thing give.
And if you didn't have a hole in your plow, it would flip up and hit you? And
yeah. Well, I've been kicked over the hill many times with a root cutter plow. Tearing up, plowing new ground. Man, I've been thrown all over them hills.
It don't seem possible just to think about it, but it's, once you get a hold of it,
it's completely a different story.
You can't turn it loose.
Well, you got to hang right on. Oh, them were good old days, though. Let me tell you, they were.
Yeah. How long did you do that before you had to leave?
No, I did that. And by the time I was big enough to plow, I was plowing. Then I worked in the oil field that one year for Dad. And after I was in high school, still plowed the horses. Well, they never had a tractor. They never bought a tractor until I dropped them in Florida. Well, I had a big pair of bay mares, bigger than Molly. That we used the mower machine all the time and do our work. And then Daddy had a little Charlie horse, and so he sold Judy after I came to Florida. Now that was a pair of horses. Little Charlie was a pair of, and Judy was a pair of horses just about like Tony and Blackie. Now Judy was a black mare just about the size of Blackie. And Charlie was a little bay horse, not an ounce bigger than Tony, not an ounce. And he was on wire wheels, boy, let me tell you. He didn't have a brain in his head. That horse didn't have a brain in his head. He didn't know when to quit doing anything. I took him and that little Judy mare, put him in a number 9 McCormick Gearing mower machine, worked for a neighbor. And I covered more territory in 2 days than his big pair of horses did in a week. But they didn't know. They didn't know what quit meant.
Well, now you know it's like this work out here. You might need a heavy tractor for some things, but a lot of things it's better to have a light one.
That's right.
Now take an old hay rake. What do you need with a big heavy tractor?
You don't need you don't need no big heavy tractor. You can take a gravity fed hay rake and put them behind a pickup, or Daddy does, and rake all the hay in this country with a pickup truck.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You take one that drives a wheel driven as it rolls, why, you can just rake all the hay in this country with a pickup truck. Take that old pickup truck out there of mine and rake rings around the tractor.
Yeah.
Sure can.
Yes. And it moves on.
That's right.
It's maneuver. You can maneuver it.
Yeah.
You know, I know that. Well, now, you see this putting out fertilizer. If you want to put 5 tons on your tractor, that's a different matter. That's ridiculous anyhow.
Yeah.
What I've seen it done. But now your little horses, they'd cultivate anything.
Better than the big horse.
Yeah.
They don't tear down as much stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you like a little horse for that purpose.
Take a little horse. A horse like Tony, for instance, his foot ain't but about so big. Mm-hmm. Oh, you take a great big horse, he got a foot as big as that plate.
Yeah.
Now, if he steps on a row of beans, look how many beans he's going to tromp down.
Yeah.
Well, if Tony steps on a row of beans, he ain't going to make it down to two or three stalks.
You can't overcome it.
Yeah. And you can turn them right around in the center of a bulk if you know how to do it.
And you don't get a big horse that's as willing as this little horse. I never saw a big horse that was quite like that.
I just about give up all hope for selling him because.
Hush.
Every time I see him, I think of old George and little Charlie.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you see, he's so willing. Anything you want to do, you go out there, and he's ready to do it.
Yeah.
Well, now you can't get around that, could you?
No.
Because your family's not like that.
No.
And nobody you know is like that.
I'll go out there and call for Tony. If I want to go pin cows, why? He's ready to go. He may not know how, but he's willing to try.
That's right.
He's willing to try.
You just can't get around it.
Now, he's young.
Yeah, he's just 4 years old this spring.
Yeah.
Well, now, I'm just thinking. You know, you used to pull things around with a wagon. Well, how would a pair of little horses do to just an ordinary wagon?
Yeah, take it and go on with it. Yeah.
You got different wagons, some of them big and heavy.
Yeah, you got different sizes, same just like trucks, a different size truck, well, a different size wagon.
That's pretty much to hitching them up.
That's right. If you get the traces too high where they're pulled too high on their shoulders, why, they can't handle it. You got to make provisions and drop it down to where they'll be, where it'll be pulling down on their neck instead of pulling up. You know yourself, you can't pull as much on an angle up that way as you can if you're pulling out here and pulling up. That's the same way with a horse. Exactly. You could pull yourself, and if it wasn't for gravity, you could pull yourself and just walk right on up through there. Where if you was pulling up on anything, the harder you pull, well, the tighter you get. That's the same thing, the same way with horses. You got to have them done right, or they ain't going to do. They just ain't going to do the job right.
Yeah, there's so many things they can do. So many things. I don't know how it'd be. Suppose you had Tony now and you had a little one-horse wagon. And you see what you wanted to do, just work out of it. Just like you would in that pickup truck. Just throw your tools in there and work out of it.
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't that do just as well as having a pickup truck? Tony moves.
Sure. He moves over the ground as fast as you can drive a pickup truck. Where you're going to take your fencing and equipment. And he'll go some places that a pickup truck won't go.
Sure.
That's right.
Sure will.
His wheels don't skip.
Yeah.
No. And his motor don't burn no gas.
Yes.
Seals.
And no license tags.
That's right, no inspection sticker. No flat tires.
No flat tires, that's right.
Oh,
and he's always glad to do it.
He's ready there, he's ready willing.
Yes, and the whole gas tank don't leak out.
Mm-mm. And gas tank don't leak.
Well, they ought ought to be some way we could hitch him up to one of these other horses. Of course, we got all these tractors too. You know, I hadn't thought about that, because you know, if it wasn't for the darn weather, you know, there hasn't been a week's work here.
No. All the work that's been done could have been done in 3 days.
3 days. And all that I'm going to do could be done in two. And here it is, May. Let me tell you, get them, those hyacinths will blow on one side. They'll all come over there. Well, now some of them are far here, and you see, that's in shallow water, they won't move. But out in there they will. I've got to put my mind on that. I haven't thought of anything short of that elevator. Now, an elevator will rust out with all them wet hyacinths on it.
Mm-hmm.
They got them little motors. But you wouldn't have any, you couldn't have an electric motor down this. What you want to do is say like an elevator. Have something there where you can just push it up there, and the elevator will take it, do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Then take it on up there high enough to drop it in a trailer, and take it off out of the way. And you see, like with you kind of silage up the country there, you can put something in the trailer to pull it out. You see. Get where you want to go. Does Alvin have that sort of judgment? You haven't seen him.
I don't know. I haven't saw him since the night out the chicken fry, and I didn't get to talk to him then.
Well, Cookie, what's the hang up on the beef out there? He needs beef. He needs to slaughter an animal too.
I don't know.
Just putting it up and feeding it. It's not good unless you do that, is it?
The type of cattle that he's got is not, no. Me and Toby, we're going to kill one in about another 2 weeks. It's half Angus and half Brammer.
Mm-hmm.
Growthy.
Mm-hmm. What's Toby up to now?
he got a bunch of this old dog fennel, you know, what they call dog fennel in some of these pastures. And he went and bought him a chopper to run over, ride it down, cut it up. Then he's going to go in there and take a plow, turn plow, and plow it under.
Yeah.
You see, if he don't chop it up, ride it down, chop it up,
yeah.
Why, he can't plow it under.
No. He don't have a rotary anymore?
No, huh? His buddy's got one, but it's wore out. He's afraid to use it.
Yeah.
And he's the type of fella that if he uses it and tears it up, it ain't worth a quarter to start with, but he'd have to buy him a brand new one.
Is that right?
Well, he gave $25 for this chopper last night. That's why he wanted to, that's why he come down and got the trailer. Couldn't get it in the pickup, see.
Well, how'd you load it in the trailer? You got it lifted.
Yeah, like we loaded that, color packer back there.
Yeah. Oh, I said, well, you gotta have something to lift it, to draw it up on.
He used my come along.
Tree or a limb or something.
Yeah, sitting under a tree, and you just use the come along. So you hook it up in a tree, raise the end of it, back the trailer and under it.
Sure. Yeah. So he bought one.
$25. And gosh, them sharp them blades on there is worth more than that.
Where'd he find one for that?
Over in southeast Gainesville somewhere, back of the Tongue Oil place. That new painting place come in Gainesville. Back down in there behind it someplace. Him and Frank went and got it. I was still water pumping. I hadn't got no water pump when they left. I better come down there.
How long did you work on that water pump?
All afternoon yesterday.
You didn't do any work, you just on the telephone.
Yeah, on the telephone. Fussing and cussing.
They sent it over there and sent you one, then sent you another one?
Yeah. Then they sent me another one. They sent me three different pumps, and none of them was right.
Yeah.
I had to go get the one I wanted.
And then you had to get a new one. And double the price. Well, we can knock around. There's a good chair out there on the front porch.
I ought to go get some gas for the AC.
I think I've got some out there. I'm not sure. I get that trailer. Oh, the devil. This trailer's got that old fertilizer in it. I got a ton of fertilizer in that other trailer. Something. All that hay down there.
They could use a pickup.
Sure.
I'll set that feed out of me. I've got 100-pound bag of feed in there. I'll get it out.
Well, you think we better check on them and see what's happened to them?
Yeah, see if their company's coming.
Tell them we are ready to go to work.
Yeah.
Number
481-203-0-05.
Well, see, the receiver's off the hook. I think they do that on purpose. Just one little nigga family.
Can't even get the operator.
Oh, no. No, you can't do that half time. Eight-party line. Isn't that a fraud? And they charge you for that.
They ought to pay you to have this.
You got no protection. You can't sue them. You could sue them. I guess you could. There's a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But they can give you any sort of service and still charge you for it.
Yeah.
And if they don't, if you don't pay them, they don't have to sue you. They just cut it off. That's a monopoly for you.
Yeah.
See. They ought to have to take it to court and, like to say, show cause.
About Dallas to you?
Yes, he talked to me about his experiences
going there personally, just in these places that he could generate support and change the situation. And I think he did. And he would have. I think that he well received some time. They stood out in the rain hurting in Fort Worth. And not anything that can be as helpful to a candidate than to have a good audience response from the kind of people that you think in your judgment will elect you. And there are a lot of folks that sit in mahogany panel offices that forget to go vote. But most of the people out there in that parking lot that morning had their candidate, and it was pretty apparent to the president and to me that it was Jack Kennedy. Last words President Kennedy said to me in the presence of my baby sister in Fort Worth, following his appearance at the parking lot and at the breakfast that morning. It was about as near bragging as I ever heard him. He was enthused by the crowd that stood in the rain and met him there at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. He asked me to come up to his room, and I told him, my sister, that I wanted to meet her. My sister, Ms. Lucia Alexander, lived in Fort Worth at that time, and she's now moved to Memphis, but I warned her that she was a favorite in my family. So he said, well, come out of the room, I'm going to change my shirt before I go out to the plane. And he said to me, with my sister standing there, you can be sure of one thing, we're going to carry two states next year, Massachusetts and Texas. We're going to carry at least two states. And I said, we're going to carry a lot more than those two. And that ended the conversation. He told my sister goodbye, glad he met her. We went down and went to our plane, and he went to his.
It's still unbelievable, you know, that you can hear the voices of the men of history. He's back on if you want to hear him.
Would you like to describe for us what you saw, what you felt during that motorcade?
We left Fort Worth ahead of the President's Air Force One. We landed in Dallas around 11:30. Ms. Johnson and I got off the plane and shook hands with a group that were there to receive the President. We moved back with the dignitaries, welcomed the President and Ms. Kennedy as they came off the plane. He was happy, smiling, and I think stimulated, as I had said, by the Fort Worth experience that morning and by the previous day's experiences. And Ms. Kennedy was radiant and looked charming and beautiful in that pink hat and pink suit. They'd gotten a big Lincoln with Governor Connally because the President arrives with the first man of the state when the first man of the nation comes to visit. They got a big Lincoln and drove away. Ms. Johnson, Cindy Yard, and I got in car that was driven by a patrolman, and Rufus Schoenberg was our Secret Service escort. As we continued to drive, once we heard some sound. Some thought it was a firecracker, some thought it was a gun, some thought it was a muffler on the car backfiring or something. Very shortly after the sound, the first sound, just almost instantaneously, a very confident, cautious Secret Service man jumped over the front seat and shoved me to the bottom of the Lincoln. He told Ms. Johnson and Cindy Yarber to lean over as far as they could so they could get their head below the back seat. He got on top of me and put his body between me and the crowd.
This was Rufus Younger.
And he had doing his knees in my back and his elbows in my back and a good 200 pounds all over me. And the car was speeding up, and covering me kept the sound from coming in there. May have muffled it, but I'm just not sure.
Do you recall at all your first premonition of a major tragedy involved in this thing?
Yes, I think that when they said, let's get out of here, and the next thing we're on the way to the hospital, just almost shoved us into the hospital and to the room, first room that could come to, down the corridor. We put all the shades in the room, closed it, and we sat there to endure the agony and wait to, for the reports that came in from time to time.
Now, when did you first know that it was President Kennedy who had been hit?
Yes, after we got in the room and people started coming in with reports that had been outside and who had seen them going in. And then President Kennedy's staff and Secret Service agents were giving us constant reports. I suggested that maybe we ought to try to get up there, and the agents just emphatic no, and I suggested that maybe Ms. Johnson then could go. And they agreed that she could. A member of Congress, Congressman Wilkes, was there, and he escorted her and kind of protected her from the crowds along with the agents. And they took her up, and she saw Ms. Kennedy, talked to her, saw Ms. Connelly and talked to her. And we were just agonizing and hoping against hope that it was not a not serious down the room until the fateful word came.
When you first were told that it was the president who had been shot, did they thereafter sort of break it to you easily, or did they right away tell you how serious it appeared to be?
I think that they told me the president had been shot, and that Governor Conway had been shot, and that they were going to the operating room with Governor Conway, and that the president was gone.
Was gone. The very first conversation you had then, the first you knew about it, was...
No, we had reports that they had moved, that they had taken the president in, and the president was wounded. But, I mean, no one discussed the gory details or how the president had been hit or anything of that type. The greatest shock that I can recall was one of them saying that he's gone. And it was...
Who brought that word to you?
Kenneth O'Donnell.
Was there any sort of, on your part, momentary panic of all of this great load of responsibility being placed on your shoulders so suddenly? Did you
never had any responsibility like that, but I've not been free of problems, troubles all my life, and responsibilities, and my knowledge of history, I knew what had confronted the past presence before.
Did you have any feeling that you wanted to be alone a moment just to gather your thoughts?
No.
What was your first decision after hearing this news?
To ask that the announcement be made after we had left the room and in an unmarked car and were en route to the presidential plane. So that if it were an international conspiracy and they were out to destroy our form of government and the leaders in that government,
account of the assassination in Dallas.
So he didn't know himself what it was, did he?
Mm-mm.
So it's your job to hold it.
No, somehow that just staggered.
Air Force One rather than Air Force Two, which you had had throughout the trip up to then.
I guess I did, though. It was suggested that we go to the plane and that we go there as quickly as we could and we go to Washington as quickly as we could. I won't recount all the details, but I raised various problems and questions to those things, and we thought them out and exchanged views, and I was of the opinion that everyone felt that what we did was the thing to do. And I never heard any question about it for many months. I mean, the question about whether the president should ride in the president's plane came along a good many months later, afterthought.
Nobody raised the question there in Dallas.
It was not accepted that it should be done. When I got to the plane, I called the president's brother, the attorney general, Bobby Kennedy, and asked his advice and judgment on where the oath should be taken, under what circumstances, and who should administer it, and so forth. And discussed it with him. He gave me his immediate reaction, but said that he would check into it and call me back.
What was his immediate reaction on this?
That the oath should be taken in Dallas at once. I said, well, I'll have the oath, and he said, well, I'll have it given to you right away. And very businesslike, although I guess he must have been suffering more than almost anyone except Ms. Kennedy. He told me what he'd do, and he did it. Momentarily, General Kassenbach called me and read the oath to my secretary, Miss Marie Famer. She took the oath in shorthand. And Ms. Kennedy arrived. We had decided and notified him that the plane would not take off until Ms. Kennedy arrived with the president's body. I wasn't going to leave without her. When she got there, we had word that we'd made the arrangements for Justice Judge Hughes. And we were in the plane about 15 minutes or less before Judge Hughes arrived. We took the oath and we were off.
What is the urgency about taking an oath at once? Does it really matter that much?
Well, I assume until you do, the oath is symbolic, and it means, I think, that you are the president in the public mind and in the minds of the people of the world. And as you
speculations about my heart attack and my physical ability and things of that kind. And I guess that put most of them to rest, that I had to physically move from the hospital to the plane, that I had to take the oath, that I was the president. And I think most important, Walter, that the country had a man in charge and a man in a position to act and make decisions. And it's good for everybody to know that here and abroad. That we're not rudderless. We do have a person that the Constitution provides that shall succeed to the presidency, and he has already succeeded. And he is in a position to transact business and take whatever actions he needs to take to protect the Republic.
Were you startled at the appearance of Mrs. Kennedy when she came to the plane?
He used the word startled. It was a tragic thing to observe here when this delicate, beautiful lady, always eloquent, elegant, always fastidious, always the fashion plate. And I remember getting off the plane in Dallas a few hours before, and contrasting that with how she looked then and how she looked when she got back on the plane after the trip through the streets of Dallas in the hospital. And there she was, and what that morning was a beautiful, unsoiled, nicely pressed, pink garment that was the last word in fashion and style and looks. And that she got off the plane wearing, and she still had the same garment on, but it was streaked and caked and soiled throughout with her husband's blood. And Ms. Johnson asked her if she wouldn't come in and let her help change the clothes. And she said no. Maybe a little later she would ask Mary if she wanted to go in that bag.
Who was Mary?
Mary Gallagher, her assistant.
When Air Force One landed at Andrews Air Force Base, the first man aboard was Robert Kennedy, and the reports that afterwards said that he rushed past you without a word to go to the back of the plane where Mrs. Kennedy, the body, were. Did that happen, and did you feel any offense at that moment?
I don't recall that. I don't know. I would not have felt any offense. In a critical period like that, carrying the burden and troubles that he was carrying, I would have thought the natural thing to do was go as quickly as you could to the widow, Ms. Kennedy, and to try to console her and give her strength. And I'm sure that's what he did. And I would have found nothing improper in him. I worked with Senator Kennedy as Attorney General for several months after that. No brushing by, back and forth.
Was the arrangement that had been made in Washington for the removal of President Kennedy's body a surprise to you?
Yes.
You had envisioned a little different arrangement in Washington, I gather.
Well, I don't know that I had thought out all of the logistics of the leaving the plane, but it didn't occur to me that the ramp would be removed and we would not be privileged to go down the same ramp where the body is.
Do you have any idea why that arrangement was made? Did you ever inquire?
No.
Considered a family matter?
No, I just observed it, as I did many things, and we had plenty of problems those days that were ahead, and this one was something. Not that I was aware of until several months later. Because of the present staff, the people worked at my trusted confidants on my front door and back door, and they were there serving me and serving the country. And Mrs. Kennedy and I were in frequent communication during all those early days, as we had been throughout the years. At least certainly during the early days of my presidency. And I have seen, heard those reports. I think there must have been a calculated effort on somebody's part, I don't know who, to try to make it appear that didn't get along with the president's staff, although I enjoyed them and asked them to continue to serve me, and they did. One of them went in the cabinet, and all of those left to their own choice several months later. I know that there were stories about the Mrs. Kennedy feeling for me, but Ms. Kennedy talked to me and expressed herself to me a number of times. And for the stories to have any merit at all, there would have to be a lot of hypocrisy involved. And I know that that's not a term should never be associated with Jacqueline Kennedy.
Now we come to the difficult decision you had about the delicate decision of moving into the White House itself. You like to recount your thoughts about that, you know, problems connected with it?
Well, the physical location of my activity was not a matter of concern to me. The thing that concerned me and those around me very much was trying to give the world a picture of stability and to give them the confidence that they would be worthy of their recognition and their support. And to do that, we had to have the assistance of some other people in other countries and here at home. For instance, I thought it quite important that I have the cooperation and the assistance of the former presidents, President Hoover, President Truman, President Eisenhower. I not only had their assistance and cooperation, I had their enthusiastic help. President Eisenhower got in his car and drove down from Gettysburg and sat in my office, borrowed a yellow notepad and a pencil and sat there for him a good while and wrote out his views, his suggestions to a new president. He says, the first man I call to Washington is Robert Anderson. Ask him to come down here and counsel with you on the tax bill and on some of these other things. I asked him to come in the next day and he did. He said, the second thing I do, I work out arrangements for leadership, have a joint session with the Congress, and I would present my views to the country. And at that time, I would say that we're going to have no special favorites. Business or farmers or laborers, they're all going to be treated fairly. And they have no...